The Right to Question is supported in part by Humanities Montana and by listeners like you.
What authors have inspired you to write?
Oddly enough, I mostly read a lot of nonfiction because I am a journalist, but one that inspired me to write was Anne Rice. I just really liked her style and how she could combine historical and just make it come alive.
For me, Toni Morrison was a huge influence. The book that I read over and over and over was The Bluest Eye, which I recently found out that's one of the most banned books in high schools across the country. And it's beautifully written, and it's tragic, and yet it's hopeful, which I think a lot of the writing in our anthology reflects that tragic but hopeful.
I was inspired by a lot of science fiction authors, Frank Herbert, Isaac Asimov, and I actually read a lot of comic books. Frank Miller, Alan Moore really kind of inspired me to make stories and see how they fit together. But I am a huge, huge fan of serials and stuff like that, magazines and blogs and articles and Adrian's writing and my sister's writing.
I would have to break it down to a couple. The guy that got me started writing, I actually was Kerouac. I read On the Road and when I was 19 and just a little ways into the book, I had already started writing because there was something about that book I wanted to reproduce. I think that's the difference between writers and non-writers, is that non-writers read a book and they love the book, and writers read the book and they try to reproduce what they're reading in some way or another because they like it so much. It's a strange thing to do, but that's just what writers do in my experience. And that and Hemingway's short stories and then Alexei's first book of stories, which was kind of opened a door for me in the sense of, like, I had never read anything about a reservation before of any kind, you know. And when I read that book, it was almost like I didn't know you could write about that until I read that book. Because up to that point, I had never read anything but non-Indians writing about a non-Indian world. And after that, it was just a progression from there to where I am now, where I very slowly started trying to figure out how do I write about the world that I know.
Hello, and welcome to The Right Question, a program that features authors from the Western United States. I'm Cherie Newman, talking with four of the authors who contributed stories to a collection titled Off the Path, an anthology of 21st century Montana American Indian writers, Volume 1. With me in the studio are Adrian Jawort, editor of the book, Luella Brin, Eric Leland, Big Man Brin, and Sterling Holy White Mountain. Adrian, where did the idea for this anthology come from?
Publishing is always something I wanted to get into in one way or another, whether it was a magazine or making books. And it was a combination of factors last year, actually. It was me seeing the movie Winter in the Blood, and I was able to finish this short story I'd been working on about my own brother who had died. And then I'd met a young author, Cinnamon Spear, who's in the anthology, and she had some work that was just blew my mind. I mean, she was 26 at the time. And then also Sherman Alexie, they're trying to ban his book in Billings. And then I just seeing how people were so passionate about it. And after that, I was like, we can do our own and people are going to like this stuff. And turns out it was a good hunch.
You're Northern Cheyenne, right?
Yes.
Well, I'm concerned that there are two Crows and one Blackfeet and a Cheyenne in the same room, and I'm feeling like somebody's not going to make it out of here alive. That's really what I'm concerned about right now.
Well, we'll do our best to avoid casualties, Sterling. Adrian, how does traditional Northern Cheyenne culture influence your writing?
See, there's like certain factors, like one of the stories in there, my brother doesn't know he's dead yet. In the Cheyenne culture, we kind of speak of the dead as if they're still there. And that's kind of what the story does. Whereas other tribes, you can't even speak their name and stuff. And there's little things like that in there. And just the setting and stuff, it's a very unique setting. mean, we're right next to these guys' Crow tribe, but there's so many differences.
And Luella and Leland, you're both from Crow Agency.
Yes, Crow Agency on Crow Reservation. We're just past a little town called Garion. We call it Benteen. It's like a little village almost, community type thing.
The area we live in, Benteen, is actually named after Benteen from the Battle of the Little Bighorn. And when he was sent south, that's actually where he turned back around to rejoin Major Reno and Custer. So we actually live where he flipped a Yui.
Wow. Luella, all of these stories are fairly intense, and some of them are dark, but they're dark in the way that a lot of short stories are. You know, it's not anything over the top. But I'm just wondering what kind of responses you've gotten from people you know, anything really negative or really positive?
Since I'm an egomaniac, I have my College Writing 1 class read this story when we're working on narrative. And I block my name out of it, and they're very into the story. And they ask who wrote it, and I tell them, oh, it was me. And they're like, well, who is it about? Who are you talking about? I don't remember hearing about that. And I said, it's made up. I made it up. And they find it really hard to believe that that story could live in my head and that I was able to put it on paper. And that's one of the biggest issues with my students is that they have so many stories, they just don't know how to get them on paper. So hopefully I'm able to show them, you know, you can do that. But a lot of the people who've read it have similar reactions who aren't my students. And everybody wants to know, well, who's it about? Who's it based on?
I think that's more typical in a small community, don't you?
Yeah, a small community. Everyone knows everyone's business. And with a story like this, like, well, we didn't hear about that. How come we never heard about that?
Is that true for you also, Leland, that your story was completely made up?
My story is about two brothers that haven't spoken in 30 years, and one of them becomes sick and requests of his other brother to help him commit suicide. The premise of the story is totally fictional. I actually had a dream about it, which is not a common way of me to write. You know, I don't have these magical dreams and then write down the stories and they're, you know, inspired from the heavens or wherever, you know. But I had been dealing with the loss of an infant son. And
your own son?
Yes. Oh. And I found the writing process to be very therapeutic. There's a lot of me in the story, but it's told from the point of view from older Crow men. And the response I've gotten from it has been positive. It's dark subject matter, but as Native Americans, we use humor a lot, you know, especially Crows and Cheyennes. And, you know, we use humor to deal with a lot of pain. And so there's some humorous points in the story. And when I was writing that, I wasn't sure that that would translate. But when me and Adrian done readings before, it's translated just fine. You know, people pick up on the jokes and laugh. It was a big relief to me, you know.
Adrian and I have talked about this, you know, on Facebook, where my whole life is now. And it's the first time I've been outside in the sun in like 5 months is today to get here. There's a response to some of this writing that from other Indian people, which is that this is too dark, or why are you telling this? Like, why are you telling this story? You know, and why are you talking about all the bad things, right? And why don't you talk about something good? Well, if you look at the history of literature, very little of it is about good things. That's one place to start. I think there's actually a John Cheever story called like A Very Happy Story, and it's about a paragraph long. And it's just him making fun of that whole thing, and basically saying it's impossible to write a short story that's just all about happy things. The difficulty I have with that kind of response is like, why are you writing about us like this? Is the idea is that fiction or any kind of art is there to meet some particular set of social demands. And if art isn't meeting those social demands, then your art is failing and you need to change your art to meet our demands. That's always the undercurrent of that type of conversation. And it drives me nuts because Everybody's always telling artists what they're supposed to do, you know, and from my perspective and in my conversations with other friends of mine who are involved in the arts, is what artists really want is they just want to do what they want to do. And, you know, and typically writers are writing about things that haunt them. And I've said that before, and I'll just keep saying it because that's what, in my experience, writers do. You know, you write about the things that you're compelled to write, and you're not typically compelled to write about, like, a really sunny afternoon. You're compelled to write about the things that won't leave you alone, and you're still thinking about years later, you know, and whatever that would be. And then it's just we are from a very particular part of the parts of the world, and so we're writing about things that are very particular to the worlds we're from. And I think that's what we're supposed to do. Mm-hmm. And it just grates on me when I hear stuff like that. And I was like, no. And the anthology to me is about that. It's about basically like literally making a space and saying, this is where we are going to tell our stories, whether you like it or not. And I like that.
I do too. Adrian, there's really a lot to think about in your story titled Where Custer Last Slept. And it's one of the darkest stories in the anthology, and several murders happen in the story. And then the narrator says it's a true story. Is it?
No, it's not a true story, but it's something that plagues me. Is on our reservation, there was a missing gal. It took a couple of weeks to find her. Then they're having trouble doing the investigation. They finally arrested the people, but it was a big story all over the news. And then they came up with like 42 unsolved murders since the 70s or something. And then my own brother was murdered a few years ago too. And people just kind of get off on manslaughter charges a lot down there since they can't get the federal conviction.
There are several jurisdictions on the reservation. You've got the county, the tribal police, and you've got the FBI. So is the involvement of so many agencies the reason that people don't get convicted and sent to prison?
The thing about the FBI is they almost have to have a really, really tight case, and they like to have a high conviction rate. So oftentimes they'll just pass a lot of obvious murders off as manslaughter and stuff because they don't have the 100% conviction probability. So,
do you think that's because it's such a wide open space and evidence is really hard to get? You're shaking your head.
Down on Crow and Cheyenne, we have BIA police, which is a federal agency, and then the FBI has jurisdiction, the county has jurisdiction, and Montana Highway Patrol. A lot of butting heads, a lot of egos. And then we have a very commonly held disdain for law enforcement. People don't like to testify. People don't like to give their depositions because oftentimes the feds will plea it out. And why put myself at risk for retaliation if this person is just going to get, instead of first-degree murder, they're going to get second-degree manslaughter? With Adrian's brother's case, that's pretty much what happened. And some of the witnesses refused to give testimony because of the person that was involved. And that's not uncommon. And there was actually the beginning of a federal inquiry into those investigation practices because it's easier to say, well, just take a plea bargain than to actually take it to court and possibly lose. And that's what Adrian's talking about with this conviction rate. These lawyers and prosecutors, they want to win, right? If I was a lawyer, I'd want to win too, but not at the expense of that much grief for the family. A lot of people believe justice is never served on the reservation, so why bother to try to help it? Mm-hmm. And it's a huge issue, and there's so many layers to it, and it's really difficult to explain quickly, but I think that's kind of how it boils down.
Someone told me, they said, you captured the hopelessness of wanting to do something but can't. That's why they kind of have to just take matters into their own hands, and even though they're just normal kids, you know, but like you said, Lee said, it's pretty dark, but...
But I think you captured the important point that they know justice won't happen, and so they take matters into their own hands. It's not that they're just mean and evil people. They are really trying to have their own form of justice because they know it's the only one that's going to happen. So that really came across in the story. You're listening to The Right Question. I'm Cherie Newman, talking with four authors who contributed stories to a collection titled Off the Path. Adrian Jawort, Luella Brin, Eric Leland, Big Man Brin, and Sterling Holy White Mountain. If you just tuned in, you can hear what you missed at our blog, which you'll find at mtpr.org/twq. There's also a link to this program on our Facebook page. We'll be right back to continue our conversation and hear about the Sherman-Alexey problem. Don't go away. Leland, your story touches on another important issue, especially in Montana. It's not just on the reservations. It's across the entire state that suicide is a really big deal.
Yeah.
So how did you bring that out in your story?
Typically, I notice, like, not just for Native American tribes or Montanans, but it seems like in the Northwest in general, there tends to be a higher suicide rate. There's a lot of alcohol abuse and on our reservation and on other reservations, like we were talking about earlier, the feeling of helplessness is very strong. You know, and we have limited resources. We have no ability to voice our feelings and our opinions. And a lot of times, not just younger people, but a lot of younger people will turn to suicide as the answer. And by no means was our project here, you know, a public service announcement, but there's no way we can avoid those issues. You know, if we want to write stories that are real and relevant, we have to talk about suicide, sexual abuse, murder, domestic violence, and all these issues that are very much real that we have to deal with, that we have loved ones that have to deal with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's so hard when they are young people, especially.
Definitely. It's tragic. It's preventable. And that's the important thing that I think people need to realize, is that all of these problems we have, they're preventable. We have the tools now to do that. But it takes a lot of work, and it takes a lot of talking mm-hmm. and education. And with our book, it's about contemporary Native American life, but it's human. We all can relate to it. These are issues that everybody has to deal with. And so it's a good place to start.
Sterling, in the first part of The Education of Little Man, False Star Boy, lots of names there, the narrator says he got his claim check and spent his own small piece of the Sweetgrass Hills. So explain what that means. What's the claim check, and what does the Sweetgrass Hills have to do with it?
Well, I mean, it's hard for me to say how widespread claim checks are, because I know that some tribes did not actually get claim settlements with the federal government. But the ones that did, for certain, they were claims that were settled, to the best of my knowledge, in the early 60s. There was very briefly an Indian claims court, and then they shut it down because there were actually too many claims, and then Congress said, we're not going to do this at all. So, like, our original reservation was probably close to somewhere between a quarter and a third of the state. And then by the time we hit our last land session in 1895, you know, it was down to where it is now. But the biggest land session was an agreement that was never ratified. And so the land was taken, but we were never paid for it. And so then what happens is that there's this claim that was settled, you know, at the federal level. And so this money gets paid out to individual tribal members. So the Sweetgrass Hills, it's actually, if you're going to translate it properly, it would be Sweet Pine Hills. And they're just east of Shelby. One of our really significant stories is actually directly related to the Sweet Pine Hills. Well, when that land was, I mean, if you're not paid for it, it's essentially stolen, right? When that land was taken, I believe it was 1877. When that land was taken, well, we lose the Sweetgrass Hills. There are still many extant fasting sites around the hills, because in that particular area, there are these rims, the Kievan Rim, which is actually a sign that looks like Kevin. It's Kievan Rim, and there are fasting rings, you know, like a ring of rocks where a guy would go sit down and fast and, like, face the Sweet Pine Hills. And those are still there. And if you walk out there, you can see them, and they're all around there. And there are old, like, eagle-catching pits up on top of the Sweet Pine Hills and things like that. But, like, we can't use them anymore. It's just sort of a story. And there was something really heartbreaking to me about realizing that not only did that get turned into money, but this is how the money was spent. And it was spent by people that didn't even know what the money was for. They just knew they were getting it. And of course, the way that federal claims work with tribes is that once you've settled a claim, part of the claim is you can never, ever, ever go back and attempt to, you know, in that case, readdress the issue of, like, we would like that land. That it's permanently legally lost, as far as I understand it. And I know that a lot of other tribes have gone through this, and this was just my particular way of trying to process that in some way that made sense to me and tell a story, because that's how I process my experience, is by writing fiction.
You have an 18-year-old with $20,000. Yes, they get the car, but then everybody knows they have money, and everybody's having a party, and then all of a sudden he's got a $50 bill left, and just that's it.
Yeah, I mean, it evaporates, you know. I mean, it would just, like, it would just go yeah. up in smoke.
As it would with any 18-year-old who didn't have a certain kind of example or financial education. Adrian, this book's title includes the words Volume 1. So what's coming next?
Volume 2 is coming next. So Volume 2, I wanted to expand out, and we have, farther than I even imagined, because we also have a writer from Hawaii in there. It's going to be called Indigenous Writers, and also one from New Zealand. What they went through mirrors a lot of what we went through here in North America. We got a few Arizona writers involved, so it's pretty widespread. I mean, also South Dakota. I'm pretty excited about it. It's, like, just about wrapped up. We're hoping to have it out by the end of the year.
I'm really proud of Adrian. He's getting out there. He's making contacts. And when he started this, he was kind of opposed to poetry, in the sense that that's not his focus right now. But I really wanted to make an attempt to edit something. And I'm a poet. We discussed it, me and Adrian, and decided that we would do a poetry anthology.
We're also working on, we're in the very early stages of a young writers anthology with high school aged students and student writers. You know, really just trying to pull in authors from many different tribes who are still very young. Me and Cinnamon talked briefly about an all-female anthology, because sometimes these men get in our way. But that female voice is different. The female Indian experience is very different than the male experience. And getting some authors in to tell those stories is important.
One of the things that I think is really interesting about this anthology and the idea of the anthology is that typically if you come across a story from a Native writer, it is a single story that is interspersed with 20 other stories that are non-Native. I think there are positives and negatives to Alexi's success. And one of the positives is that it kind of, like, opened up a very large door for other Indian writers, because he's such a public figure. And it's sort of, and just him being in the public makes it known that, like, as silly as it sounds to, like, us, yes, Indians are real and they are still here. But also, one of the downsides, though, is that, and this is the way that Americans have almost always dealt historically with Native peoples, is that, and that actually starts politically. Like, at the policy level, all federal policy is a one-size-fits-all. And so once a law is passed by Congress, that law applies to every single tribe, regardless of their geographic location or their, you know, cultural situation. And that's problematic in a lot of ways. And in my experience, that's generally how the U.S. has dealt with us in every regard. And so, you know, when you meet somebody and they say, oh, well, are you Native or you're Native? And I'm like, well, yeah, but, you know, I'm actually Blackfeet. There's a very little room for particularities. And there's such a broad range of diversity, I guess you'd say, in Indian country. And when you're just asking one Native writer to represent everybody, just by putting, you know, a single Alexi story in a collection, that somehow symbolizes that, well, we've taken care of the Indian problem. And, you know, and it's not true. It's not true because he comes from a very specific place in the world and a very specific tribe. And there's actually huge differences between tribes west of the Rockies and tribes east of the Rockies. And Great Lakes tribes aren't really like, you know, Plains tribes. And to sort of just throw an Indian out there and say, all right, well, this guy, we've got it covered, that doesn't work. And what it turns into is frustration that, like, because one of the things I hear voiced in conversations with Native writers is there's not a lot of room for different types of Native writers from different places. So what something like this does is it allows for that diversity by just saying, you know, this is Montana Native writers, and then the next volume is going to be more global and, you know, it's indigenous. But you're not only going to be hearing from people from other tribes, but you're going to be hearing from urban Indians. You're going to be hearing from reservation Indians. And those experiences are very different in very significant ways. But this is a place where all of those different types of stories can be told. And what happens from that, I hope, is that a non-Indian who's not familiar with, you know, or who maybe has only read a Sherman Alexie story and feels like, well, maybe they know something about the quote-unquote Indian experience, picking up an anthology like this, it's a way of saying, you know what, actually you only know the tiniest bit. And by looking at these different stories, you can start to see that the broad range of diversity in Indian country. And then with the next volume, it's actually going to be the broad range of indigenous experience in the world. But you're also going to see the similarities because, to the best of my knowledge, one of the fundamental aspects of defining someone as indigenous is that they are either in the process of being colonized or they are on the verge of being colonized, because indigenous people are always in the way is the problem. You know, the desires of nations for resources and land, you know, and then there just happens to be a group of people here that are in the way of that desire. And that's one of the defining experiences of being indigenous. And so I think what the anthology does is it will both show some of the universals in terms of experience between indigenous peoples, but also just how different experiences and the lives that indigenous people are living can really be.
Adrian Jawort, Luella Brin, Eric Leland Big Man Brin, and Sterling Holy White Mountain live in Billings, Benteen, and Browning, Montana. You'll find more information about them and the anthology at our blog, mtpr.org/twq. Links to the blog are also on our Facebook page. Thanks very much for listening. I'm Cherie Newman, wishing you a pile of fascinating books and lots of questions.
The Right Question is produced by Cherie Newman, with help from Barbara Thoreau and Kim Anderson. Michael Marsalek, executive producer. Beth Ann Ostein, studio engineer. The Right Question has a Facebook page, a blog, and a podcast. You'll find links to all that at mtpr.org/twq. Thanks for listening and for supporting this program.